Welcome to the Your Oxygen Mask First podcast. I'm Erin Young, and this is a space where we explore ways to help the helpers. Because you can't help anyone before you help yourself. So sit back, put your own oxygen mask on, and enjoy the ride. And thank you so much for joining us again. I'm very, very excited and super honored. I'm kind of fangirling over here because today I am joined by two mega, mega important people in the 911 telecommunicator dispatch world. Today, we're going to be talking to Jim Marshall and Sarah Gilman. As the founding chair and CEO of the nonprofit 911 Wellness Foundation, Jim Marshall is widely regarded as the 911 industry's foremost expert on 911 mental health. And Sarah Gilman is a licensed mental health clinician in California, specializing in the treatment and education of emergency responders. And guess what, guys? She's also a former EMT and firefighter. She's also served on the 911 Wellness Foundation as its mental health advisor. And she kind of co-authored this little book with Jim Marshall called The Resilient 911 Professional. And today we're going to be talking about this book and how it kind of came to be and why it's so important for 911 telecommunicators and dispatchers to have a robust backup and support and mental health. Thank you both for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Great to be here.
So we're going to start off with Jim and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, so I'll say that the best way to put an identity on Jim Marshall is that I'm the brother of a 911 dispatcher. My career was zigged off a course where I had been a private practitioner. My specialty for about 25 years was trauma and relationships and the connection between those. And so as a young clinician, I was having conversations with my sister, a young dispatcher, and realized that her world, what they did as the very first responder, was unrecognized by the clinical world, and that they were, in fact, taking an enormous impact on the calls, not only taking calls from the public in the worst moments, but dispatching firefighters, police, and medics to dangerous scenes, and that this had a huge toll on them. So there's a certain point in my career when my sister became a leader in the Michigan industry and had founded a dispatch academy. And she said, I don't care about nepotism. You're going to train my people because you get us. I'd been sit along with her and hung out with other people in 911. And so anyhow, my career took a shift from being a private practice clinician, which was not as cozy as it sounds. As Sarah will tell you, when you're a trauma therapist, you're on call a lot. It was not tidy and clean, but it was very deeply meaningful. And my experience with people suffering in trauma and recognizing what was required to help them heal, to travel through these things, all transferred directly to the world of the dispatcher who is traumatized or has the potential of being traumatized, perhaps almost daily. To make a long story short, after years training in the 911 industry, we co-founded, I should say Jim Lanier and I and a group of other people, including Sarah Gilman, co-founded the 911 Wellness Foundation. That was a nonprofit that ran from 2011 until 2017, and that was dedicated to the cause of increasing awareness and advocacy and change in the industry to support our dispatchers. There are wonderful organizations, wonderful people, but they were not mental health experts, so they couldn't see necessarily what we could see. They were too close to it. They were living it. We wrapped up the Wellness Foundation in 2017 to turn over our agenda to our national associations in the industry, who helps set standards for everyone there. And so I have continued as even prior to the foundation with the 911 Training Institute. So my full-time work now is not clinical. It is training and advocating and writing for the 911 telecommunicator in our centers, their leaders in the US and India. So that's it in a fat nutshell.
But there's so much more.
Well, maybe.
So Sarah, let's hear a little bit about you and your background.
Okay, well, how about going from current to background? Currently, I own a company called Coherence Associates in North County, San Diego, Encinitas, and we are a mental health counseling company with 7 therapists right now, and everybody is EMDR trained and critical incident stress management trained, and a big part of what we do is serve those who serve first responders and military. So how I got here was 25 years in private practice. And in the midst of that first 8 to 10 years, I was a firefighter EMT in a rural area in San Diego where I lived. And I was a mental health professional at the time. So being internal in the fire service and then being a mental health professional at the time fascinated me on what I was observing and not really understanding. And that was in the early 90s. We know so much more now about the impact of stress and the occupational hazards in first responders. But honestly, I didn't know, they didn't know. And they sent me to CISM and said, bring back what you can. So I learned a lot. I then eventually got EMDR trained, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And that really shifted the trajectory of my career and my passion for helping first responders really reboot their systems and the cumulative effect of the stressors that they're under. Currently, I'm an advocate and a speaker and a writer. And there was some point some years ago at the EMDR International Association conference that within the first half of the first day, about six people said, hey, do you know Jim Marshall? And I said, well, I've heard of him. And apparently Jim was getting the same thing. Do you know Sarah Gilman? And so by the end of that first day, we didn't even know what each other looked like. And somebody was talking to somebody and we ended up seeing each other in the lobby. And that was it. Our passion, our integrity for our work really just connected. We really felt like siblings in this world. So that was many years ago. And Jim, I am honored that he invited me to contribute to this first of a kind, well needed and long needed book, and that we're going to talk about some more later. I haven't been a firefighter on the boots on the ground in a long time, but I have been a mental health professional, boots on the ground frequently. My company has contracts with first responder agencies all over San Diego County. I just look forward to being able to share some of the insights, some of the learnings, and some of the things that we really need to continue to look at as we move forward. And in 2017, I graduated with my doctorate degree in clinical psychology after being a MFT for 30 years. And my dissertation was about the cumulative effect of chronic stress and the exposure to human tragedy on first responders and EMDR as an early intervention, if it could help build resilience and potentially inoculate against PTSD. So I am still up to my elbows and entrenched in all of this, and it's no more or less exciting than it was 30 years ago. So I'm honored to be invited to talk today and exchange some ideas and some learnings.
Well, and thank you both for being here. And I'm very excited to talk about EMDR. We are going to get to that in a little bit, but I really want to learn more about the book, The Resilient 911 Professional. So Jim, we'll start off with you first. How did the idea for the book, or maybe the action for the book, because it sounds like you'd been thinking about and trying to help for so long. How did you set it into action?
So what a fun question. You know, I wrote the introduction, the first introduction for the first version of this book in 2010. And now it was published in 2018. So what happened? Well, you know, I think if somebody is impassioned to write a book, it's hopefully because there's been an accumulation of life experience. And my life experience was one-on-ones with dispatchers and classroom experience with dispatchers and their leaders one-on-one as they traveled as comm centers through the last decade with a lot of pain, a lot of suffering, handling terrible calls involving death of children, suicides, officer-involved shootings, loss of officers, terrible house fires, etc. And I realized that what I was teaching them in the classroom was really largely because they had educated me to understand their world and apply what Sarah and I have learned as clinicians trained in trauma. And I recognized that I kept presenting at conferences, first state conferences, then our national conferences. And then, you know, those presentations accumulated over time. And I realized, you know what? If I try to advocate and help the industry along with other people realize the risk they face, and this is before there was research that had showed empirically what those risks are with PTSD and depression, which, by the way, 24% of our dispatchers with PTSD. That's an estimate based on a good study of 880 dispatchers. 24% in any given time may have clinical depression. But in advocating for all that, I realized how many years will it take to empower our people through one presentation with 100 people in the room? How many conferences, how many years? We have to have something we can place in their hands that any director, any frontline dispatcher or other responders or their family members can hold, and they can read it from cover to cover at their own on their own time. When we unpack for them the reality of what this work is like, with that headset on for them, what's the trauma like? What are their unique stressors? What do we know about the traumatic impacts of this? And then what can we do to equip them for resilience and to prevent PTSD and other stress-related illnesses? So the book was a must. I knew that I could not go any further in the 911 industry that it adopted me as a member of the family. This is personal for me, going all the way back for my sister, as is personal for Sarah, as a firefighter EMT who then was coming alongside dispatchers. This gets under your skin and become people you love. And as a massive family, they had to have something they could hold in their hands as a comprehensive guide to living out this life with resilience and a quality of life. And sometimes that's when you got to write a book. So that's how it came about. So remember, I did not write this whole thing. We have, I think, 12 other people who contributed to this book, including Sarah. And I have to give a big shout out. I would never have written this book without the co-editor, Tracy Lorenza, a career dispatcher who's now in the Boston area. And she's a frontliner extraordinaire, and she is a 911 sys to me. So we have to really acknowledge that this book would not have been written without her co-editing and her leadership.
Yes, thank you, Tracy. And Sarah, do you have anything to add to that?
Just that Jim and I have presented at conferences at the EMDR International Association many times to bring awareness to mental health professionals about dispatchers and being really the first responders. And it's always amazing to me to watch eyes light up when they realize the missing piece in the first responder realm. And Jim and I have worked some years very tirelessly at creating these presentations and empowering mental health professionals to look at the culture of first responders and how best to intervene and help them stay healthy. And Jim's 911 Training Institute has, what would you call it, Jim, the kind of the qualifiers for good mental health, and has a list of people around the country that's growing that really has been vetted to be knowledgeable about dispatchers and how to help them.
Yeah, Sarah's referring to the National Registry of EMDR Therapists for 911, and this is in its early stages, but what we're trying to do is make sure that dispatchers anywhere can find a therapist qualified to treat trauma using evidence-based treatment, and who also get 911 because they've read a chapter in a book that Sarah and I wrote for clinicians, and they're willing to do a sit-along, et cetera. So, you know, that just speaks to the fact that there's work that has to be done that we've been trying to do to educate not just our dispatchers about how to take care of themselves, but educating our colleagues clinically to be out there and ready to serve them. It's an effort on both sides.
Absolutely. I've heard many stories of different areas, my area included, where we have a shortage of clinicians that are interested or even capable of dealing with people with public safety trauma. When we're looking at clinicians to help out with CISM teams, debriefs, and everything, there's not a whole lot of people that are willing to step up or have the desire or the training to step up to help us.
Right. You know, and in this day and age of telehealth now, although, you know, there's some concerns about it, and I always like, you know, up close and personal myself, but telehealth can offer some options for people who don't have access where they live. So that's something to remember. It's worth finding a vetted, trained therapist, you know, even if you're not necessarily in the room together. Mm-hmm.
And Sarah, did you want to elaborate any more on how you got pulled in to collaborate on this little crazy project?
Well, I'll tell you, Jim was very gracious because many, many years ago, I mean, this idea for this book and the chapters and everything has been, you know, morphing over probably at least the last 8 years. And I always wanted to be a part of it. And yet when it really came to fruition, I was in the midst of a dissertation. And so Jim was very gracious to say, I can't even dare to ask you. And then one thing led to another. I was like, but I want to. And so my colleague and I in the office, we both have a couple of amazing stories in working with dispatchers. And so we collaborated on our chapter, which was really a wonderful experience for us as well. And it's just something I really wanted to be a part of and moving forward, because there isn't anything like it. I'll tell you a story. I really wanted all the dispatch centers in San Diego County to know about this book. And I couldn't figure out, okay, how am I going to do that? And so I went to the dispatch manager county meeting with, 40 something folks. And I personally myself purchased a big box of the books, showed up at the meeting with permission, of course. I didn't just surprise them. And I said, not only is this my gift to you, but this is not to be just sitting in a dispatch center. I want you to read it. There's nothing like it out there. It's upbeat, it's positive, it has great strategies, and it's real, and it's written for you. And then get each one of your dispatchers. If you say you really care about these folks, then get this book. And I don't make a dime from it. I just really, that's how strongly I felt about the information and all the authors that contributed. And sure enough, everybody went back to their dispatch centers, and there's been orders coming in so that they can provide this for all their teams. So that's really exciting because, you know, dispatchers don't know what they don't know. You know, how do you identify what's going on with you when you think it's just part of the job? Mm-hmm. You know, so the first line is to help people understand, you know, the impact and what to do about it. But if you don't know, you just don't know. And you exist in more of a surviving the career as opposed to thriving in it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
go ahead, Jim.
No, I was just saying, well said. She just nailed it.
And that's, you know, when we think about that suffering in silence, part of it is the stigma. You know, it's the same in all first responder departments. You know, these are the toughest, most resilient people on the planet. And yet they're human first and they're first responders second. And so when the human being begins to break down, they don't necessarily even know that it's a breakdown. It's a, you know, an overload. It's cumulative stress. But once they learn some of the signs to look for and some of the ways to cope in this hazardous occupation, then it gets exciting. People feel proactive. And that's why I really appreciated the title of the book, you know, the resilient 911 professional. We do need to focus on what builds resilience and how can we manage stress. You know, and I think that's where most first responder agencies are looking now. 25 years ago, we were looking at how to cope with those who seem like they're having problems. But the stigma is slowly but surely being broken through so that we can be proactive in our approach to stress management in first responder occupations.
And I'm very grateful there are people like you guys out there that are taking this on, because even 15 years ago when I started as a dispatcher, it was suck it up and deal with it or else find another job. There's no crying in dispatch, you know, and we have worked really hard to try to change that culture and change that feeling that this is part of the job. You just have to deal with it to know there are different ways that you can cope with this. And it's not just the job. It's your reaction to the job.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And, you know, Aaron, I'm really glad that you just, you know, your listeners may already know, and it might be obvious if anybody's tuned in before, that you have been a career dispatcher. But I just think that, you know, you're the reason that we wrote this book. Neither Sarah nor I want any glory in any of this stuff, because, you know, it, who are we focusing on? It's the frontline dispatcher and their leaders who live this all day. So I love to think of you. Wow.
That was a train that just is outside my window that went by.
Oh, wow.
That was pretty cool. I think that should stay in the podcast because it's one of those things that just kind of spices it up a little bit. Thanks. See if you can come by in a minute, Sarah. That'd be awesome.
This is real life.
Yes,
it is real life. Right. This podcast is not happening in a vacuum. But Aaron, I just think that, you know, it's easy for people who do a podcast to kind of just send the questions out and then the real experts answer all the questions. is. And I would like to suggest that you are what I call the console subject matter expert. You might be the one running the podcast and wanting us to do all the talking, but I really love that you're now weighing in with us because this is about you and your peers. Wouldn't it be ironic if Sarah and I wanted to do all the talking, like you're just an interviewer? That's like saying a dispatcher is just a dispatcher.
Oh, hell no. You didn't say that out loud.
Right. Exactly. That's the old idea I'm just a dispatcher. I'm just the one that answers the phone. Nothing could be more misleading in terms of the psychological complexity and the intellectual and emotional demands of the job.
Yes, we're not just glorified secretaries, but that is a whole other topic for a whole other podcast.
Right. You know, the other thing that I see happening, again, having been in the fire service and then watching sort of from the bit of the sidelines in the last 20 years, is the budding and emerging relationships and respect with police and dispatch, fire and dispatch. You know, as we all talk to one another about what it's like, you know, this secondary trauma is what everyone is experiencing, not just because you're sitting in a room with a headset, you know, you're first on the scene. And, you know, when any of us as civilians and citizens have to pick up the phone and call 911, you know, and I know I have in my life when my 30-year-old was a baby and having a seizure. And as I said in one of my talks to dispatchers, you know, I'll never know your name. I will never forget your voice and that you were right there to help me while the first responders with the equipment were on the way. And so the equipment for dispatchers is loaded internally of what they have to, skill sets and attentiveness. And, but again, think of any of us being on the calling 911. It's the worst moment in our lives. And who's there? A stranger that has worked very hard to make sure that they can prolong life, save life, and keep people safe, including fire and police and EMTs. I mean, their vision of the scene is very expanded on what they're processing. I have this 4-minute YouTube video that was 4 minutes in a dispatch center, and I show it to mental health professionals. And by the time they're done with watching 4 minutes in the dispatch, their eyes are wide open, their mouths are dropped. They're like, who does this? It's like, that's right. How do you do this? And so it's definitely a special group of people. And I'm really encouraged about some of the relationships I'm seeing within the first responder agencies.
Yeah, because it's hard to really relate to somebody who is a regular person, is what I like to call that. A civilian who has never done a set-along and has no other concept about what 911 is other than what they watch on Fox. And I get lots of questions. Is that TV show? Is that real life? And I've actually never seen it, but it's hard to, because people have these preconceived notions is that, you know, you get the call and then you solve the crime at the same time. And it's not that bad, but it's completely different.
Yeah. You know, this reminds me, you know, you had forwarded us some questions. And one question you asked was, do you think the book is important for family members to read, you know, spouses and family members? And this goes to the point you two are making. Even if you live with the dispatcher, it doesn't mean you understand what they're doing. And there are a couple challenges, enormous challenges for the dispatcher and their children and their partners. And that is that the way their brain writes, your brain, Aaron, tell me if this fits for you. I don't want to tell you about your own life, but see if you can relate to this. It's my belief that the brain of the dispatcher morphs. In other words, there's software that's written. So you are listening radically in the given moments. You are having to live life by the second. You have to zig people when they're zagging and zag when they're zigging. If you interrupt, you have to stay in charge, et cetera. Well, that kind of communication style at home can be very difficult. And as well as the difficulty appearing to concentrate on what a family member is saying, and even being in the moment, being present, being able to slow the brain down so that you can just take in and enjoy and love because of the way you have to be in life and death on the console amidst the others, you know, calls that you know, are not. So all that is to say that part of what we're getting from people is my family needs to read this, family members saying, to the fact, I'm learning something here. Because if they don't understand what the world within the head of the dispatcher is and within the dispatch center, the family takes a hit, the relationships take a hit. So the more they read from this book, the more they understand not only what happens in the center, but what happens psychologically in the mind of the dispatcher and what together they can do to grow and seek healing when healing is needed. So,
you know, I also think it gives a common language. Now, you know, even family members, you can start talking about the same kinds of things in the same kinds of ways, or to be able to ask informed questions or listen with an open ear and heart to your family member who's a dispatcher. So going through this book, it's not a technical book. It's not a a graduate level statistical. It is real. It's personal, and it's—I want to say it's an easy read, but it's an informative read, so that it—I think it will help communication in families as well as in the dispatch center. If everyone's reading out of the same manual, if you will, then they can begin to talk about the things in a similar way, which helps with communication and team building and sharing ideas about how people are managing stress.
No, I wholeheartedly agree. We actually bought the book for our center, so it's being passed around to different dispatchers, but I think we're going to get a couple of more just so that it doesn't take so long for everybody to read it. But it is a very, and like you said, not an easy read. It's not very technical, but it's conversational. I found that it was hard for me to listen to or read through the stories, and so I would skip the stories just because I try to limit my exposure to vicarious trauma when I don't have to. So that's just telling about me. But for somebody who doesn't hear those things day to day, it's a big eye opener to understand and to know that dispatchers everywhere go through something similar, whether it's a house fire where I'm at to, you know, a car wreck where you're at, we go through the same ups and downs and the same feelings.
So that's so interesting that you said that, because, you know, if at times, and I think there are different times in our careers where it's easier to read certain things than other times, but if you skimmed through the, maybe sort of the parts of the story that could potentially be disturbing, did you skim to the end to see what they did about it?
Yes, I did.
That, you know, there's each of these stories has this, okay, this is what happened, and this is what I was able to do about it.
I definitely got to that part and made sure that I took all that in.
Oh, cool.
I'm not sure who wants to answer this one first, but why do you think so many of us are suffering silently?
Go ahead, Jim.
So,
I mean, I kind of indicated some of it in terms of the long-held stigma. Aaron, you said the same thing. You know, if you can't take it, maybe you shouldn't be working here, you know, that kind of stuff. But go ahead, Jim.
Well, that is an old school message, absolutely. If you can't handle it, there's the door. So let's back this up. I'm speaking with two women right now, and, you know, I'll see what you both think about this. The 911 profession was in its infancy, really, it was the idea that any chick can answer a phone call. So put women in dispatch. Now, I'm using these terms intentionally because I'm not trying to judge those who said these things. It was about ignorance and it was about where our country was at the time. But so it was largely women, and it still is about 75% female in 91. The idea was that, oh, that's just answering the phone and sending the real responders where they need to go to do the real work of handling the emergency. The only other people who were in the comm center by appointment would have been those who were disciplined or injured officers. It was predominantly a female career. And it wasn't even seen as a career because, after all, you're quote, just answering the phone. And this is not to diss folks who are doing wonderful work secretarially. My mother was an executive secretary a lot of her life, and she was amazing at that. But to not confuse clerical work with doing 911, that's the point I'm making. But then the issue is, why suffer in silence? Well, if you're told that what you're experiencing is really just a clerical experience, then why should you worry about trauma? Why should you worry about cumulative effect of stress? Because you're not really there on scene. So the idea was that if you're not on scene physically, we're not there psychologically. Then there was no permission to seek help for this. But let's look at something also. Male culture, historically, and we're talking probably, you know, every hemisphere of the world going back, you know, many thousands of years, the male culture's dominant way of dealing with emotion, which I call your emotional code, what you believe you should do with what you feel. We talk about this in the book. Pretty much for our responders, Sarah, I mean, Sarah was a first responder. In three words, what do you do with your emotion?
You override that system because your training has to kick in and you have to be in the moment. They do come back later, whether you realize it or not, in some form or fashion. You know, the body is an energy system, so that human response will show up at a later date or a later time in some form. So it doesn't, it's not as if you're not experiencing things, but there we are trained as first responders to override it and move quickly towards the danger, which actually goes quite against our biological nature. So training is key. We get training in overriding our emotional brain, not in how to reset it later. So there's been this big gap of we know how to get to the call and do our job, but we haven't, you know, and I was a firefighter, what, in the early 90s. So we had excellent training of how to get there, do what we need to do, assess the situation, get everybody to safety. And that was it. Oh, and how to clean up. But not how to reset or reboot the impact of the humanity and the stress management later.
Right on. So without that training, you could sum up what our first responders as well as our military learned to do in real time. And that was, you can sum it up in three words, the emotional code. What I believe I should do with what I feel right now is suck it up. Suck it up. So, you know, why are people going to suffer in silence? Because the culture said, suck it up. So what happens if you feel the need to cry at the end of a call? A dear friend of mine who's now deceased, he was a paramedic extraordinaire. He had lost his own son. Okay. Now I don't want to pull us off on the sidetrack, but Aaron, this brings the point home along with what Sarah just said. His name is Michael Stanley. I have permission to tell the story. The book is dedicated to him and to my sister, by the way, Deborah Ochtenberg, retired. But Michael lost his son to a drowning. Was then sent as a paramedic, and he was the chief. He was the lead paramedic to a call within 6 months of his son drowning, and it was a boy who had drowned. There was nothing they could do to save this boy. Now I know that in itself can be vicariously traumatizing for our listeners, and so we want to encourage them to the help that they need. Sarah's going to talk about EMDR here in a bit. All this is to say that when Michael had that call, they did everything they could unsuccessfully. When it was done, they had cleared everything and there was no more work to do. They were just, you know, putting stuff back on the rig. He sat on the back of his rig and he wept. And what he said, without judging his peers whatsoever, is, and no one came to my side. Not one of the paramedics came to his side when he was weeping like they had never seen him weep before. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't because they didn't care. It was because they were stunned and they had learned that you're supposed to suck this up. He had been chief among those who suck up. And so they didn't know if it respected him more to suck it up or not. But if you think about it, when a responder cries, and many of us in the culture, when we cry, we say, oh, he really fell apart, or he really broke down, or he really lost it. They're all derogatory terms that disallow feeling expressively the pain. So this is the culture that we, along with our first responders, are working to change. So there's permission to express and seek the help.
Jim, would you like to read a passage from the book and kind of expose our listeners to some of the concepts?
Yeah. And I think, thank you. I think what I can do is just say, you know, here's some examples of the titles of chapters, if that's okay.
Sure.
So they can get a feel of the book. Because, you know, what you pointed out, I think that is the kind of judgment that you used in reading. That's what I trusted with some of the stories that were really difficult. I actually had an editor's introduction to those chapters saying, this chapter may be difficult for you. If you're struggling, you know, for example, with suicide risk, please seek help immediately and skip to another chapter. I can't remember how exactly I put the wording, but you used judgment as one who has been a dispatcher because you knew what would be triggering. we had to really trust in this kind of partnership between us as the writers and the readers who are responders, to not impose on yourself sections of stories that would be too difficult. Otherwise, we would not have put the stories in whatsoever. And that would have been too extreme. So I really applaud your selective leadership of the book.
Yeah.
I just
talk about self-care.
Exactly.
Working on it.
Yeah, Erin,
Right. And that's something, if you didn't know that that's a good thing to do, you might have just tried to plow through whatever instead of managing your tank. So that was great.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. And this is really something that with fear and trepidation I thought about when we put this book together is I never want to harm people in our effort to do good. So I would encourage everybody who gets the book, read the parts you want to read. That's the whole idea. It's in your hands. You can decide where to steer it. So here's an example of some chapter titles. The first one, Golden Glue, a 911 dispatcher story of resilience. Next one is Days and Nights in the Dispatch Center. What I saw as a scientist, experienced as a person, and how it changed me. This is a sociologist who really lived for like 3 years in a dispatch center. Next one is Understanding 911 Stress and 9 Unique Risk Factors Faced by Dispatchers. Chapter 4 is with a researcher, Michelle Lilly, facing the impacts of 911 stress, the reality of PTSD and depression in the comm center. And then we move into the equipping. 5 is building the resilient 911 mindset. Part 1, your well-being depends on your emotion. Chapter 6, building the resilient 911 mindset, the choice point strategy. So that's just section 1. There are 4 sections. The next section tells the stories of a couple who went through PTSD, a young man who also went through it and what they did to get help using something called EMDR that Sarah talks about in chapter 9. Her chapter is, does your console need a reboot? EMDR therapy for healing traumatic stress. So what I'd like to do is rather than dig into these stories too much, I'd like to just read a little portion of the foreword by Tracy Lorenzo and then a little bit of her chapter 1. And so I'll pause when I finish some of this foreword so that Erin, you or Sarah can comment how you want to commandeer this. Does that sound okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is Tracy speaking. Remember, she's a career dispatcher. She's worked in the Detroit metropolitan area for many, many years, and now is in Boston. Have you ever looked at your console and said, that's it, I'm done? Or turned to your partner and noticed they were struggling and you didn't know what to do or say to help them? You're not alone. And that's one of the driving factors behind this book, to let all dispatchers and call takers know you're not alone. There is help in many forms. As you journey through these pages, you'll meet several people who have been touched by the 911 dispatch profession. Some of these people are or have been dispatchers themselves. Some are therapists, scientists, and even medical doctors. There are directors and those who have served in the military. We are your authors. Our chapters will cover many facets of a world that deals with trauma on a daily basis. We've pulled our knowledge, our experiences, and our genuine concern for the health and well-being for all 911 professionals to create this guide to help you survive and thrive in the 911 world. As you walk through these pages, our hope is for you to become physically, mentally, and emotionally healthier than when you turn the first page. We hope for a more resilient you. And she ends the preface, I'm jumping ahead, speaking to all those readers who she believes, and we do too, that everyone who benefits from 911 service should read this to get a clue about the people and the expense they pay personally for the service they provide. And so she says to all those who are non-dispatchers out there, closing your preface, dispatchers are a proud yet humble group, but we are suffering. We have always been the nameless, faceless voice on the other side of the receiver, answering your calls and cries for help. Now, it is your chance to help us. Tracy Lorenzo.
It's so powerful and so impactful, and it really sums up the nature of the job that we do and what we experience. And my hope is to, with this podcast and other things and the things that you guys are doing, that the regular civilian, the regular citizen, the people that we work with, the police officers, the firefighters, our center management, city council, county commissioners, they understand and they get a better glimpse into our lives. And by writing this book and by that foreword, it definitely helps.
You know, coming from you, that means the most.
Yeah, for sure.
Right, Sarah?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
So, go ahead.
Oh, I was thanking you. I appreciate it. It's from us that we are the people that are never seen but always heard to get highlights and to be appreciated and for people to show appreciation. That's huge.
Well, and
you know, I think it's interesting. Another dynamic, Jim, as you said, historically, even though still it's 75% of dispatch are female, are women, you know, and although I hate to generalize somewhat, but you know, women, we are bred and in our brains to be caretakers and to take a backseat in putting ourselves first or advocating for ourselves, because part of the attraction to dispatch is look at all the people I'm helping, you know, look what I can do in serving others. You know, I'm helping the officers, I'm helping the firefighters, I'm helping the citizens. I mean, it's a thrill. Is it not, Erin?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
because we are biologically caregivers, and not to say that men are not, don't hear me say that.
Yeah, but, I'm done. I'm so, gonna, I'm gonna end our friendship.
Yeah, right, Jim. So I think that when we look at that, it's such an attractive job. It's such an attractive career for that those unique people who can multitask and all that, to be the best caregiver, if you will, that we can be. And yet there's a price that's paid. There's a cost. And if the cost, and that's why I love the title of your podcast, you know, Oxygen Mask On First. It's not worth it if the quality of your being and your life is so diminished, but you're still getting a paycheck and you're still helping other people to, you know, for what purpose? And that's the, what we're, I think we're trying to bring the message is to be what the best version of you while you're being this incredible caregiver with an amazing skill set.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's important for not only the brand new shiny kids that come in and they want to help and, oh my gosh, this is the greatest thing ever because I'm the first person to know everything. I'm here helping people. I'm loving the adrenaline rush that I'm getting off of that hot call, but also to the crusty senior veteran dispatcher who we throw Snickers bars at because they're just over it. I think that this book can help both sets of dispatchers. It's not tailored just for the new kid or, you know, the senior person. So that's what I love about it too.
Thank you. And you know, that's true. The feedback we're getting from veterans is, oh my gosh, I'm learning so much and I've been in this career for so long. But I want to tell you, I believe the reason that the book is succeeding at that is because clinicians didn't write the whole thing. It would have been a disaster if clinicians took credit.
Yeah, pretty much.
Right? I mean, I got to tell you this. This is funny. Oh, go ahead, Sarah.
No, I was just going to say that I wrote our chapter because the dispatcher that I wrote about changed my life and changed how I see the world and how I see resilience and how I see the work that I do. I don't want to be a crusty old therapist who's burned out. And her experience, and I'm not going to tell you about the chapter because you have to read it. And that was that story came from 1999. It's still, when I reflect back on it, has influenced me in ways that give me hope and excitement about what we're doing and moving forward. Mm-hmm. So, you know, mental health professionals are caregivers. We get burned out and crusty and cynical also if we're not taking care of ourselves and if we're not feeling inspired. You know, when a dispatcher is no longer feeling inspired or honored or humbled by the amazing work they're doing, they've got an overload inside. They've got a buildup inside that's getting in the way of having access to the joy in life. Right on. So that's, you know, what it was really the dispatcher that has, you know, compelled me in her story and her experience and our interaction together as her mental health professional.
Yes, therapists are people too. And you're never going to do anything for Jim ever again after he said that, right?
We've weathered some stuff, but we've always just gotten along wonderfully. And because, you know, our friendship is so like focused on the mission that it's bigger than us. And
you know, honestly, Jim, though, we have kept track of one another in terms of our own self-care, because life happens when you're trying to be on purpose and be passionate, and all sorts of things happen in all of our lives that are traumatic or sad or difficult. And, you know, we have to, you know, walk our talk. And sometimes that can be challenging because we give to the point of exhaustion and then we have to kind of get rebooted. So that's one of the things that the book talks about is, we have all of us have a full life. And so how is it all integrating? It's not anymore about work-life balance. Mm-hmm. It's about self-balance and family balance. And work is a part of that.
Right.
So, but we bring ourselves into our work. And so want to make sure that, you know, there are times that we have extraordinary challenges personally.
Sarah, can we talk about EMDR?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Many people have heard of it. Many people have not. It is not new. EMDR is a comprehensive psychological therapy methodology that is called eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. You know, over 25 years ago, it was utilized for PTSD, single incident traumas. And what we have discovered over the years and through tons of research is that utilizing EMDR by a trained mental health professional early in someone's exposure to traumatic stress can potentially inoculate against the development of PTSD. So this is what we're looking at. I like to think of it as our brain is the supercomputer and our nervous system is the networks. And we take in sights, sounds, smells, and everything every day. And for the most part, we're incredibly resilient as humans, and we're able to file this data in organized ways. You know, the dispatcher takes in sound, sights, and fills in the pictures in their mind of what is going on. And so that's when we say dispatchers are psychologically first on scene. They have to assess and sort of sniff out, if you will, very, very quickly what is necessary and what is important to activate. And so EMDR, we think the reason it works in its simplest form is it replicates part of our hardwiring systems called REM sleep. And REM sleep is our innate wisdom of how to file data in organized ways so that we run efficiently. Now, one of the things that's disrupted frequently with first responders is sleep. So when sleep patterns are disrupted, shift work and long hours, getting called out, is REM sleep is disrupted. So the ability to file data is either delayed or ineffective or inefficient. And so a lot of times when people are having stress symptoms and they're not sure why, they can come in to an EMDR therapist and get what we call a reboot and utilize the EMDR therapy as a reset in the system to really pretty much impact someone's ability to sleep as well as to file the memories in a way that doesn't creep up on them in some other fashion like flashbacks or irritability. So it's remarkable. And it's fast. It's not a quick fix because it's not that there are many layers to every human being. I've always appreciated Dr. Francine Shapiro, who originated, founded, and researched this therapy because she kept it in the mental health license community. And a lot of research has been done. It's in the top three methods for PTSD. It's, you know, what the first responders say it is, because that's a whole nother language. They say it's effing magic. So that really sums it up. And I am not sure, you know, being able to help people reboot sooner than later is it's just such an honor. And, you know, that's why I think that this life balance that we all need to work on is, I still love coming to work. I've been EMDR trained for about 28 years now. And it's no less remarkable to me when I'm seeing in front of me what's happening for somebody and being able to restore their sense of who they are and their energy and their joy and getting through the weeds of this misfiled data. People are not broken. They're just, how would you say it, Jim? It's a pileup where they're like either slugging through mud in the, you know, feels like, or, you know, that rainbow circle on the computer when the computer's buffering. It's like that. You know, when your system's inefficient, you just can't seem to sync up. And EMDR therapy has a way of resetting and rebooting the system quickly so that you can get back to feeling synced up and better. Did I leave anything out?
I think that was...
Boy, I don't think so.
Pretty concise. When people talk about the flashbacks or the hesitations or thinking about the job or the looping and the thinking or even the self-esteem, you know, dwindling down to not feeling very good about yourself. EMDR has a way to the system. The therapist is really a facilitator. The person in front of us is really their brain, nervous system, and heart are bringing to the surface exactly what's needed to refile. We're not going on a digging expedition. We don't go through every, you know, ounce of somebody's life. We watch the system and listen carefully on what is being brought up at the time that's in the way. And it's really remarkable. It's not traditional old psychotherapy. Talk about it for, you know, 10 years and then hope it resolves itself. It's much more efficient than that.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for giving us that explanation. And if you guys are interested in EMDR, I encourage you to look up a EMDR clinician in your area, because from what I've heard, it is magic. And Sarah, I know that you have to go because I was so into what you guys were saying that I lost track of time. So I will...
That's okay. I can hang out for a few more minutes.
I will post the link to your company page in case anybody wants to get a hold of you through your company as well.
Sarah, the way you've described EMDR is so awesome. You've really, what you guys don't know is that Sarah won't toot her own horn here, but she's been the president of our International Association of the Therapists that do EMDR worldwide. And I don't say that because woohoo for her, but to say that she's dedicated so much of her life to helping people experience EMDR and helping our clinicians stay well and optimize the way they do this. Here's the bottom line. We have a nation and a hemisphere full of first responders, not just dispatchers, but the rest of our first responders who don't even know that you can heal PTSD. So when I'm training all over the place, in Survive and Thrive for dispatchers, one of the first things I tell them is you can heal PTSD. Let me tell you how. So this is why her chapter in the book is so important. And the rest of the chapters in the book, yes, we talk like other books have about hard things that happen in 911. But the reality is every chapter, we're leading people towards a whole suite of solutions. There's so much that we can do to keep our people resilient and well. So this is not a sad sack book. This is a book that's full of solutions that are not cookie cutter and phony. It's about what do you do to prevent PTSD, compassion, chronic stress response. So there's a lot in here, including peer support, that is.
Can I piggyback on this?
Yeah.
I have a very cool story. And I told Jim this the other day, is when I said I took the box of books to all the dispatch managers in the county. Well, one of them called me months later and he was so excited that he and I have put together, now they're saying it's mandatory, a resilience checkup for their dispatchers every year. And it includes a resilience, you know, as the book indicates, assessment, personal, one-on-one with our team, our mental health professionals. It's not therapy because they have access to that, which is, you know, been a big first step, peer support, access to good mental health. But what this proactive manager is doing is he got the funding. We're launching the program in just a couple of weeks. mandatory, proactive approach at assessing your resilience on an annual basis and developing stress management skills. And I was so excited. And that was just by him going through the book and realizing that we need to be proactive with dispatchers and not wait for problems. So that's just a really cool story, I think.
That's amazing. That should be in every dispatch center, everywhere.
Well, and I even said to this group, I said, I'm not giving each of you one book to sit in your dispatch center. I am giving you this so that you will purchase it. Tell your dispatchers you care about them, and this is the way to do it, and give them their own highlighter so they can read it and reread it and look again. And so in this dispatch center that we're doing, we call it the Resilience Initiative, everybody's getting a book as part of the launch of the program. And then they're getting one-on-one assessments and then follow-ups. So to me, this is what this is all about, a manager who's stepping outside the box and really wants to create this for his team. And when you think of it from a business standpoint, in terms of cost savings to have a healthier workforce, and we're even going to do some assessments, you know, before and after every year, so that we can see how is this influencing work productivity, sick days, workers' comp, you know, work-life satisfaction. So again, I think many more managers can step out of the box and say, hey, you know, we've got to do something and we got to do it now. And here's the guidebook.
Yeah. And also liability too, because if your dispatchers are happier, they're going to not make so many mistakes.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, Jim, I do want to thank you because, you know, it's one thing to go in and talk to people, but when you have something as robust as this book and user-friendly, you know, I just get to carry it in and it carried the message. I'm hoping that's going to happen all over the country.
So Jim, how do we get this book? How do we find it?
Well, that's obviously a question that I love answering, but I got to say, this is just so heartening. It's so encouraging. When I sit with the dispatcher just yesterday at a conference I'm at, I won't even say where it's at, but to hear the story of the suffering they're going through and then be able to say, here, just take this and let's talk further. Let's have a one-on-one, but also take this and read this. So how can they get it? Well, first of all, on Amazon.com, all they have to do is type in the Resilient 911 Professional and they can order the book. Depending, Amazon changes the price from time to time. I'll make sure they get the best price, but if somebody's buying bulk, I had a ComCenter buy 200 books. So on our website, if you go to 911training.net, we have a lot of resources there to also talk about all the training that we do. But on 911training.net, in the resources tab, in the shop, S-H-O-P, you can purchase a book volume, over 25 copies there. And depending on what the rate is on Amazon, you get the best price there. So we want to make sure that people are not paying money. Mm-hmm. They should. Okay, so that's how.
And Sarah, if anybody wanted to get into contact with you through your company, how do we find you?
CoherenceAssociates.com. And you can email us or give us a call if you have a question. Remember, too, that you can go on the EMDR International Association website, and they have Find a Therapist. And there is now a designation for EMDR therapists if they are first responder competent. So be sure and look up. You can put it in the search of first responder competent EMDR therapist. So perhaps there's some in your area. So the EMDR International Association has this designation under the click on Find a and Therapist.
EMDIA.org.
Right.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, both of you, for joining us. I do truly appreciate everything that you guys have done and continue to do. And I look forward to seeing more from Sarah and Jim and the 911 Training Institute as well. Thank you, guys.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen today. And I hope that you found something that really resonates with you. I can't wait to share even more. So please subscribe to the podcast. And you can find links to our resources in the description and at youroxygenmaskfirst.com.